Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Yusuf Saleh, and I'm a clinical lecturer in neurology practicing in Oxford, UK. I'm also the research and resident representative for the section panel in the EAN for cognitive disorders and dementia. Today's special topic is on brain circuits. And in today's episode, we will talk about how they can be used to diagnose and treat neurological disease. My guest today is Tan Dong, a senior neurology resident practicing at St. Olav University Hospital in Trondheim, Norway. He's currently establishing and leading the Clinical Brain Systems Research Group at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. He completed his PhD in functional neuroanatomy at the Kavli Institute for Systems Neuroscience. Welcome, Tan, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Yusuf. My pleasure to be here.
Tan, you've had a really interesting background and have been exposed to a really cool science over the course of your career. So we should really start by asking a little bit about yourself, maybe giving us an introduction, how you got interested in brain circuits.
Thank you for the question, and thanks for the invitation. It's really, really nice to be here. So I would actually start in the late 20s, not that I was born at this time, but I think it brings us to an interesting time period where there was this patient, HM. So it was a young man that unfortunately suffered a bicycle accident, and then he developed this very severe epilepsy that led to the need for surgical resection of both of his medial temporal lobe in 1953. And this affected dramatically his memory and cognitive performances. And 20 years later, neuroscientists took advantage of what we learned about this patient in order to understand what are the brain circuits that may underlie this function and these function deficits in this area, but in an animal model. And John O'Keefe in the 70s placed electrodes in the hippocampus of a rodent and found these very specific cells called play cells, leading to the discovery 30 years later, approximately in Trondheim, Norway, where I'm actually working, about this other type of cells called entorhinal grid cells. And together, collectively, these discoveries were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine in 2014 to John O'Keefe, Maybrit, and Edvard Moser. And that was more or less a landscape where I actually entered the field of research. So I just started my journey as a fresh medical graduate, and I wanted to understand what are these brain circuits that give rise to these very interesting cell types. And there was this very well-established model for a quarter century that we have a parallel organization pathway in the brain. And I studied heavily with methods in animal models. And we found actually that this brain circuits model was not entirely accurate. And that was an eye-opening experience because, you know, finding something that was so important to reveal key finding in the mammalian brain seemed, you know, very strange for a new, you know, PhD student. But then, you know, we also wanted to know how we can infer this knowledge in, you know, non-human primates. And we made some hypotheses that were quickly, you know, taken further by other groups abroad doing human research. And they found essentially the same thing in human brains. And I thought, wow, how can we, you know, find new things in rodent brain circuits when we, you know, claim we know so much about human brain circuits? Maybe we don't know so much. And how we can, you know, push this knowledge. And when I entered residency, it was a very natural question to, you know, dive into. You know, I found it just fascinating.
Well, thank you for a really nice introduction there. Okay, well, before we carry on, why don't we ask the simple question for the younger members of the audience? What exactly is a brain circuit? What do we mean by that term?
And that's a great question. So we have about 86 billion neurons in our brains, and each of these neurons have about 1,000 to 10,000 synapses. So if you take that into account, we have more connections in our brains than the stars in the entire galaxy. So how do we make sense of this complexity? Well, we have to break it down into two different things. And brain cells, neurons, usually, you know, we can have them, you know, in our mind as a conceptual highway where axons are essentially propagating a signal that is a functional signal. And we know that neurons communicate with action potential. So we have a way to measure structural connectivity, looking at the axons and the fiber bundles. And we have a way to measure functional connectivity, looking at different functional signals that reflect the action potentials when they, you know, are firing in the brain in different places. So I would say that this is a gold standard. This is what we can measure in animal models because we have, access to invasive tools. But of course, in the clinic, we don't have access to these tools. So we have to turn to other methods. And usually they are split in two categories. We have neuroimaging on one hand, and we have neurophysiology on the other hand. And when it comes to imaging, you can, of course, do tractography. So look at the structural connectivity of very large fiber bundles. And some people use also functional MRI, so you have more information, indirect information about the activity of neuronal populations. But of course, I mean, this method operates at a scale that is not matching the scale of the brain cells. It's, you know, millimeter scale, millisecond, you know, like functional signal. So sometimes you also have to turn to neurophysiology. You can think about like a scalp EEG, for instance, and then you get a very nice temporal resolution. But of course, you are missing then the spatial resolution. You have just a couple of electrodes, you know, trying to map out the brain circuits, but we are missing like, you know, what we know in details about the organization. So I would say that's what we use today.
So that's what we use. And you talked about a lot of really interesting techniques here. We talked about sort of structural MR and functional MR and neurophysiology. But what are we trying to look at when we say we're looking at a brain circuit? I guess to the uninitiated person, conceptually, what does it all mean? What is a brain circuit? Is it a set of neurons connecting to one another? Is it a set of brain regions connecting to one another? And you know, why is that important?
Yes, yeah, so that's true. Perhaps I should have started with this. So I would say it's, different neurons, brain cells that are connected to each other, and they form together a functional unit or a system. You can call that a circuit, a system, or even a network. But they have, you know, some kind of functional information that is flowing through. And perhaps it's easier to give example, very concrete ones for the audience, right? So to keep it simple, we can take a very simple structural brain circuit. We could take the corticospinal tract. We have a patient that arrived in the emergency room. He has hemiparesis on the right side. Likely, he has a lesion in the left corticospinal tract. Now, whether it's sitting in the brainstem, in the pons, in the primary motor cortex, in the midbrain, we don't really know. But we know it's affecting very likely either one area that is going through the upper motor neuron in this pathway or lower motor neuron. So that would be the circuit for motor activity, I would say, in a very simple term for the audience here.
Yeah, and we can simplify it even further if we moved away from the brain. I guess a circuit can be something as simple as the three sort of point circuit of the myotatic reflex. So something as simple as your knee-jerk reaction would be a nice example of a neural circuit. So with a sort of afferent neuron, an interneuron, and an efferent neuron representing a very simplified circuit. And so the term is conceptual and, you know, doesn't have to be complex, but actually we are interested in those circuits in the brain. And tell us why we might be interested in those circuits in the brain.
Well, I mean, when we work as clinicians, we are expert in phenotypes. So we know that a collection of symptoms might be indicative of a certain pathology or something we should investigate. And often we want to understand what is the biological substrate of this phenotype. And we have this construct and understanding of how certain dysfunctional brain circuits might underlie this phenotype. And sometimes also we have to, you know, go to other levels to, you know, genetics, molecular biology, cellular biology, in order to really understand the fine details of this specific symptom, which would be just essentially a dysfunction of, you know, brain circuits. And I think it's very important because if we gain a better understanding of these brain circuits, then we can bridge the gap between this very fundamental science, such as genetics, molecular and cellular biology, to the different phenotype that we, you know, encounter daily in our clinical practice. So I would say that it's essential actually to learn more about this and to learn about the limitations we have also in the clinic to understand them in order to approach a bit closer to what they actually are.
Yeah, very nice. And maybe you can give us a couple of sort of real world examples of circuits in the brain that might be relevant for certain clinical conditions.
Yes, indeed. So one circuit that I think is very interesting and that is used quite often, for instance, would be the nigrostriatal pathway. That's something that is critical for movement initiation and control. And it's going into a lot of different circuits also within the basal ganglia. But it's a quite interesting, I think, especially when we enter the field, because we know that the integrity of this particular projection is very important for a group of diseases, and especially for Parkinson's disease or Parkinsonism in general, where we know that if we actually miss this projection or it degenerates, then we will develop a collection of symptoms. And the historical account, I think, is also very interesting when it comes to Parkinson's disease, because it's not only, you know, a single pathway degenerating and leading to a lot of different symptoms, but we have been learning a lot in terms of brain circuits the past few years, starting maybe 40 years ago when actually there was a neurologist in California called William Langston that I'm sure a lot of people know here, that received a group of young patients that had actually the clinical phenotype of Parkinsonism. But they were pretty young and it was unusual, but they had absorbed this drug that was containing a substance called MPTP, and that was damaging these neurons located in the substantia nigra, leading to degeneration of this pathway. And why I think it's particularly relevant is because this substance was subsequently isolated, MPTP. It was used to create an animal model in the monkey in order to cause a Parkinsonistic phenotype and to develop new tools, both therapeutics and biomarkers, in order to, you know, reverse back this knowledge into human patients. So there is a lot of things that are relevant across phenotype, but I guess Parkinsonism is a very nice and direct one to understand.
That's a really good example, in particular, thinking about, you know, how the different components of the basal ganglia interact with one another and how that may become dysfunctional in Parkinson's disease. Before we come back to that, actually, with a sort of view towards how we can modulate the circuit, maybe we can give a few other examples just so that we can have a sort of broad view of the circuit-based approach to neuroscience before we delve into the depth of how we can modulate the circuit. So, you know, there are some really other cool examples, and I know you've done some work on the epilepsy side. So, you know, another sort of interesting model where circuit-based neuroscience can be applied is in epilepsy, in particular, focal epilepsy, where seizure activity or abnormal electrical activity can start within the medial temporal lobes and then sort of propagate to other components of the brain, perhaps the thalamus, and then from the thalamus onto the rest of the cortex. And in my field, sort of looking at motivation disorders, things like clinical apathy, you know, we're particularly interested in this frontostriatal thalamocortical circuit. So from the prefrontal cortex to the ventral striatum within the basal ganglia through the thalamus and back up to the cortex. And these sort of what we call thalamocortical loops are very heavily implicated in the development of motivation disorders, such as clinical apathy. And so we have several types of circuit within the brain, each of which have a specific function, but also may be affected in different types of disease. Would you be happy with that sort of summation?
Yeah, so it's really nice. And actually, you know, if we can reverse role for a second, I do have a question for you, because we are both young neurologists and scientists, right? And I think that, you know, we have to be experts in certain phenotype and we have often to subspecialize into one of them, whether it's in neurodegenerative diseases or or epilepsy or movement disorders or headache research and so on. But you mentioned very nicely in this example that you are looking at a symptom, which is apathy, that is dependent on circuits that are affected across different phenotypes or pathologies. And perhaps Alzheimer's disease would be one. Perhaps you could have stroke leading also to apathy. So would you agree or would you disagree that, you know, we have also as clinicians to look beyond the clinical phenotypes and to have a better understanding of brain circuits underlying this phenotype?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the taking an approach which, my PI, Professor Masood, is saying, we call a transdiagnostic approach. So that's cutting across different diseases with an eye to common syndromes across these diseases. So in this case, clinical apathy can happen in, as you mentioned, Alzheimer's disease. It may happen in stroke, in Parkinson's disease. And you really want to understand whether it's the same circuit that's affecting all of those and whether across the different diseases, those circuits are affected in different ways. So is it part of the circuit? Is it the whole of the circuit? And what's the underlying cause of dysfunction within that circuit and that disease? So I think it's good to have a transdiagnostic view. I suspect that people who take this circuit-based approach to neuroscience will want to look across diseases more than others. And, you know, there's a benefit to that, but there's also a benefit to being a specialist in one type of disease. So I think they both approaches probably complement one another.
Yes, absolutely.
So why don't we, having sort of talked about lots of types of brain circuits and how they could be interesting and affected in disease, why don't we give a couple of examples of how these circuits can be used to guide treatment of neurological or psychiatric disease?
Yes, sure. So maybe staying in the realm of Parkinson's disease, I would highlight one publication earlier this year by Nandita Rajamani in the group of Andreas Horn in Boston. It was published in Nature Communication. This paper was very interesting because what they essentially did is they gathered a very large collection of patients from five different centers. I think it was about a little bit over 200, where they had the structural MRI of these patients. And this patient had received deep brain stimulation electrodes in their subthalamic nucleus on each side. And they had this clinical score that we use for Parkinson's disease before and after stimulation. And they wanted to make sense, you know, of which tracks, which circuits in the brain actually modulate symptom improvement. And they used a method called connectomic deep brain stimulation, which is maybe a little bit heavy for the audience, but making use of normative brain atlases in order to look at the fibers that cross the different areas that are stimulated by electrodes and be able to select these fibers. And what is beautiful is that they put them back into a model and use this model in order to personalize the treatment of patients with deep brain electrodes. And it's quite interesting because now it's not like one size fits them all. You know, we are really moving toward precision medicine with a circuit-based approach that is very specific for each patient that have different symptoms despite suffering from the same condition.
Yeah, and I think that was a very nice paper, just to kind of go back a step. You know, the subthalamic nucleus is part of the basal ganglia, and again, part of this sort of circuit through which regulates smooth movement in normal people and might be hyperactive in Parkinson's disease. And so some people stimulate it using an electrode, and that can help restore some of the movement. And I think what we're learning now is that stimulation generally will not work the same across people. And what this study, as you mentioned, did very well is it gave us a window as to why stimulation might not be equally effective in everybody. And it's, well, everybody has different anatomy, and actually being able to track the fibers that go from these small millimeter long nuclei up to the targets in the cortex or otherwise, and stimulating the right fibers will give you possibly a much better effect. And as you mentioned, this takes us a step closer to this term, which is used quite a lot, this term of precision medicine. But it also takes us maybe away a little bit from the traditional pharmacological model of treatment. And that's not to say that it should be replaced, but perhaps this is something that can be a complement when thinking about the different treatment approaches to patients.
Absolutely. So perhaps I could then mention another example, because I would not like the audience to believe that, you know, brain circuit therapy have to be invasive. You know, we can do neuromodulation, as you mentioned, very nice way, that is essentially a focal intervention on the brain circuits. That is a drastic departure from the pharmacological agents, that the tablets and, you know, different drugs that patients take and that cross the blood-brain barrier and, you know, spread across the entire brain. It's a very nice way to, you know, affect the circuits. And maybe not in the field of neurology, but more in the field of psychiatry, about 4 years ago, a group in Stanford led by Nolan Williams came up with this extremely interesting neuromodulatory treatment based on previous research, where you use essentially a coil, a magnetic coil, that is called, the entire, you know, machine is called a transcranial magnetic stimulation, but you apply essentially a coil over the head of a patient. And with this magnetic coil, you can induce electrical activity in certain parts of the brain. And usually it's used for patients with mood disorders, such as depression, and it's placed over the left dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex in general. But what happened in this really nice protocol is that they developed not only a more intense way to deliver electrical pulses, but they target specifically the area in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex using fMRI by doing, before the treatment, you know, fMRI in single patients and really mapping how this little cortical area, you know, was, you know, connected to other cortical areas. Perhaps we don't need to get into details, but it was a very nice way to show personalized treatment in a non-invasive fashion. And maybe the most interesting thing of all is that the remission rate reached 90%, which is, you know, of course, there was follow-up studies, but it's extremely impressive. And at least, you know, equally, you know, working equally well as electroconvulsive therapy that is causing a lot of side effects in these patient groups. So there are windows into, you know, using this knowledge about brain circuits and methods to personalize treatments with very efficient results, I think, and promising results.
Yeah, really nice second example here, just again highlighting this idea of the transdiagnostic possibilities of circuit-based neuroscience. So we can cross disease models, thinking about circuits in the brain across neurology or psychiatry. Of course, one additional point is to say it doesn't have to be electrical stimulation. For example, we know that the frontal striatal circuit that we're interested in motivation disorders is heavily innervated by dopaminergic neurons. So you can think about whether neurotransmitter-based therapies can be used in models which have this circuit significantly affected. So why don't we stop and summarize, because I think we're approaching time. So we've had a really nice discussion about this idea of brain circuits, and we've defined them as, you know, interconnected brain regions or interconnected neurons, which are connected to one another to serve a specific function. And we've talked about how using a circuit-based model is a nice way to bridge between a sort of molecular approach to science and maybe the macro or clinical approach to science. And we've discussed some examples of how these circuits can be effective. So, for example, in epilepsy or Parkinson's disease or motivation disorders, and finally, how those circuits can be used to personalize treatment to one's own anatomy, using some non-pharmacological approaches, which are being developed as we speak, such as, you know, deep brain stimulation or transcranial magnetic stimulation. And finally, thinking about how this circuit-based approach can make us think about the brain as a whole, regardless of the neurological or psychiatric condition that's being affected. So what do we need to do to improve our knowledge of this area, and how can we motivate young people to join this this field of neuroscience?
So that's an excellent question, and thanks so much for summing this up, because it's, of course, not something we talk enough, I think, in our clinical curricula. And perhaps if we want to push this knowledge a little bit further, I think, as you mentioned as well, we have to think, you know, in terms of transdiagnostic possibilities, you know, not to restrain ourselves to one single phenotype, but be able to talk to other clinicians who are working with other phenotypes. And I think increase the dialogue also with scientists. And especially there is an entire field looking at these brain circuits that is called systems neuroscience, since these brain circuits essentially form systems. And this field has been, you know, undergoing a total revolution for the last 2-3 decades with novel methods that is really, you know, deciphering the small details of these circuits in the mammalian brain. And the next question is also how we can, improve communication with these people and to some extent maybe use some of this knowledge in clinical practice. And these things are happening, I think, or will happen quite soon.
Wonderful. Tan, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. I'm sure we could go on for another half an hour if we were allowed, but perhaps we can do this over a coffee.
Thank you so much. And thanks to the listener, EAN, and all the colleagues that have been talking and supporting us. Have a nice day.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.